So good morning and welcome, especially to our guests that are here today. Maybe I'll just talk very briefly about the evolution of this talk, which most of you have had this experience. For those who haven't, one of the things that Zen teachers do is poke, probe, and stir. And the origins of this talk come from a certain amount of poking, probing, and stirring that occurred back in November. And I've been kind of thinking on it, about it, and working on it since that time, and have discovered what a really complex subject it is. And as Ray said recently, it really could be an entire book. So as you become bored by this somewhat lengthy and complicated talk, consider yourselves lucky that I haven't written the book. So, because of the destructive potential of martial arts, throughout the centuries, serious practitioners have been deeply interested in questions pertaining to the appropriate use and restraint of this potentially lethal violence. I would like to begin these remarks by first acknowledging this fact, and second, by expressing my respect for all who have engaged in this deep examination of these questions. I especially want to honor and offer gratitude to all of the great teachers of our arts who have developed and preserved them so that they have been handed on to us in this present day. Whatever we are able to see today is only because we are standing on the shoulders of giants. Certainly, I have a personal viewpoint that will undoubtedly be apparent as this talk proceeds, but I hope these remarks will not be taken as judgments of those who have preceded us or as assertions that there is an absolute right position on this subject. As will be seen, there are many views on this subject. What I believe is important is our commitment to this dialogue, to this process of questioning and ultimately growing both individually and as representatives of our styles as citizens of our nation and of our world. Since time immemorial, the warrior hero has stridden forth as the guardian of the people against its enemies, both real and symbolic. This powerful archetype has been an essential figure at the core of the mythologies of virtually every culture. The warrior hero has emerged to slay the dragons and monsters. Joseph Campbell tells us the flash of the warrior's blade prepares the way for the emergence of the creative energy of the source as the outworn is cut down. The mythological warrior slays the status quo, allowing the process of becoming, of transformation, to continue. On a practical level, the warrior archetype inspired those persons who had to risk life and limb in order to protect the group, clan, tribe, village, province, or nation from those who threatened its safety and existence. One can only assume that young persons hearing the stories of the great heroes of the past, both real and mythical, aspire to perform similar service for their people in spite of the very real physical danger to their own person. These two manifestations of the archetypal warrior, the spiritual hero and the practical defensive warrior, are very much alive and present within the martial arts today. On one hand, there are those who believe that martial arts have some spiritual purpose which should lead the practitioner away from egotism into a deeper appreciation of and connection to all life, ultimately manifested in the desire for nonviolence. On the other hand, there are those who see martial arts primarily as a set of physical skills meant to resolve physical conflict as efficiently as possible. Nowhere can the distinction between these points of view be seen more clearly than in the contrast between two 20th century figures in Japanese martial arts, Morihei Ueshiba and Masatatsu Oyama. Ueshiba, founder of Aikido, the way of harmony, came to renounce violence even in the dojo and saw his art as a way of bringing spiritual peace and harmony. Oyama founded Kriyoshinkai, a style of hard, full contact fighting honed in the brutal combat of the Thai boxing arenas of South Asia. John Stevens, quote C.W. Nichol, who had met both of these men, to be in the same room with the karate master, Masatatsu Oyama, notorious for slaying bulls with his bare fists, was a frightening experience. But when I visited Ueshiba Sensei, I felt nothing but warmth and light. However, these two polarities are not discrete, but rather they can be seen as representing points on a continuum that corresponds to the eight patterns of conceptual organization that have emerged as human consciousness has evolved. These levels have been identified and described by Beck and Cowan in their study of mimetics. The term meme, derived from the Greek root mimeme, refers to a unit of cultural information, in a sense equivalent to the gene as a transmitter of physical form, and which, like the gene, is capable of adaptation over time. The introduction to Beck and Cowan's work describes a series of broad genetic or cultural codes referred to as V-memes, which stands for values attracting metamemes. Such a V-meme reflects a worldview, a valuing system, a level of psychological existence, a belief structure, an organizing principle, a way of thinking, or a mode of adjustment. The V-meme is therefore conceptualized as psychosocial DNA. Just as DNA evolves, so the V-memes change and evolve in a dynamic interaction with the environment in which humans live. Each individual, in turn, has dominant V-memes that guide and shape their development and values. It is likely that as we explore these V-memes, you will recognize those that provide the primary premises and principles that organize your thoughts, values, and ways of relating to the world. Beck and Cowan don't offer an explanation of where these V-memes reside, but precisely how they are transmitted from generation to generation. I would theorize that they reside in a number of places, including the culture, the individual psyche, and perhaps even the collective unconscious that Jung talked of. The eight V-memes whose emergence they have identified are as follows. The first V-meme is survivalistic, that is, focused on the basic need to stay alive. A distinct self barely emerges, with the consciousness being focused on the most basic and essential priorities of food, water, and shelter. In the modern world, conditions of great privation, whether through poverty, famine, drought, or personal catastrophe, can result in the emergence and manifestation of this pattern. The magical V-meme saw the entities of the clan or the tribe emerge. These, in turn, are seen as being dependent on the spirits who are satisfied through ritual observance. There is a strong allegiance to the chief, elders, and ancestors. Certainly many indigenous and third world cultures are organized around this principle. In our cultures, gangs and strong ethnic and familial enclaves also manifest the clannish aspects of the magical feeling. In a world that is unsure with threat and predation, the impulsive V-meme encourages you to be free to be who you want to be and do what you want to do. There is movement to gain respect and attention while acting without guilt or remorse. The impulsive V-meme gives rise to the desire for conquest and domination. Beck and Cowan attribute the unbridled conquest of Attila the Hun to this level of organization. We might conjecture that a fusion of the tribal allegiance of the magical V-meme and the unrestrained violence serving desire to gain respect and attention that arises from the impulsive V-meme underlies the force of terrorism in the contemporary world. Beck and Cowan also suggest that the epic hero is a product of this V-meme. Certainly, when the hero archetype exists independent of any transcendent principle or allegorical theme, this may be the case. Similarly, any of the gratuitously violent heroes of contemporary action movies, wreaking havoc on their enemies while blithely making wisecracks, exhibit the nearly sociopathic violence of the impulsive V-meme. Unfortunately, this includes much of the Hollywood portrayal of martial arts, where the bold and unrepentant character, played by actors such as Van Damme and Seagal, is only briefly and superficially influenced by any moral values, as the predictable formulaic plot evolves. Once they have reached the point where their volcanic violence erupts, the wrathful nature of the impulsive V-meme hero is manifested. Further, there are those martial arts practitioners who ascribe to this view. Many of these persons disregard the codes or value systems of the traditional martial arts, which emerged later with the purposeful regime, preferring the systems that are purely combative and aim and claim for a high degree of street realism. These persons are often anxious to have an opportunity to use their arts. This tendency also shows up in the arenas of ultimate fighting and similar combative contests, which are wholly without any theme that suggests the redemptive aspects of humanity. The next theme is purposeful, in the sense that the self is now superseded by a cause, truth, or a righteous pathway. The purposeful world emphasizes rules of conduct based on this principle, either with a future reward or a reward that is inherent in the adherence to the principle of itself. Most of us in the traditional martial arts are very familiar with this vimeo. It was the dominant vimeo of the samurai and bushido, which later gave rise to budo, the martial arts code that is precisely the type of righteous pathway that is associated with this vimeo. In the case of the samurai, the orderliness of the purposeful vimeo was often strongly influenced by that of impulsivity. The early life of Miyamoto Musashi, the great Japanese swordsman, typifies the result of the interplay between these two schemas. By the age of 30, Musashi had fought 60 duels or contests in which all of his opponents had been killed. Later in life, he abandoned this killing, adopting instead the way of Kendo. Kendo arose as a fusion of the sword art with the spiritual basis of Zen Buddhism. In my view, this early period of unification of the samurai life with Zen could be viewed as a dark period for the latter. At this time, the insights of Zen were bent to the service of the swordsman's art of killing. The Zen teacher Takuan Soho, who taught Musashi, among other famous swordsmen, wrote the following passage in a letter to Munomori, the son of Yagu Muniyoshi, the founder of the new sage shade school of the sword. Suppose you see the opponent's sword come, but do not allow your mind to stay with it. Suppose instead that in the response to the coming sword, you do not think of striking back or form any idea of judgment, but the moment you see the sword raised, you move in, your mind not tarrying, and grasp the sword. Then you should be able to wrest from the opponent the sword intended to slash you and turn it into one with which to slash him. Going further in another passage, he says, if we put this in terms of your own martial art, the mind is not detained by the hand that brandishes the sword. Completely oblivious to the hand that wields the sword, one strikes and cuts his opponent down. One does not put his mind in his adversary. The opponent is emptiness. I am emptiness. The hand that holds the sword itself is emptiness. Understand this, but do not let your mind be taken by emptiness. How ironic that the last sentence is, do not let your mind be taken by emptiness. It is precisely being taken by emptiness that appears to allow this killing of another human being to exist without hesitancy and devoid of any feeling. In effect, by suggesting that the swordsman dwell in emptiness, a moment of perfect sociopathy is created, with no responsibility and no regrets. Yet I would argue that Zen that does not move beyond mere emptiness to the awareness of the one body, to the understanding of the precious nature of all living things, to the life-giving action of compassion, to our responsibility for all beings, is not Zen at all. Takuan's teaching has persisted in sections of the martial arts world to the present day. Hyams relates a conversation with Bruce Lee regarding Bruce's response if he were to be attacked. Bruce explained that he would probably seriously hurt or kill his attacker. However, he further stated that in court his defense would be that he was not responsible for his actions. He did not kill the person, it did. That it, he further explained, was the state of mind of Mushin, action without conscious awareness. He went on to read a passage from Takuan, explaining that when the mind is empty, it is not the man, but the sword in the hand of the unconscious that strikes. Perhaps Taquan's explanation was simply as far as he could take the violent samurai in the direction of adopting Buddhism. These were men who sometimes fought and slew lesser opponents simply to test the sharpness of their blades. It could be argued that a Buddhism that aided and yet moderated their violent ways was the beginning of the transformation from senseless violence towards kendo, the way of the sword as a spiritual path. Tomio, in the Bodhisattva Warriors, points out that Buddhist teachers have long seen the warrior's confrontation with life and death and with the transitory nature of existence as creating an opportunity for spiritual development and progression. As a result, Buddhist teachers have often addressed warriors in their teaching. It was about this time that Yagyu Muneoshi brought a new sense of responsibility to the samurai, developing the idea of the death-dealing sword and the life-giving sword. The death-dealing sword served the selfish purposes of personal gain and showing prowess. The life-giving sword only killed to protect others and ultimately preserve life. It seems likely that this terminology was built on the Buddhist concept of the sword of wisdom, the sword of Manjushri that both gives and takes life. However, in the Buddhist metaphor, refers to cutting through delusions, eventually taking the life of the greatest illusion of the small self, separate self, thereby giving life to awareness of the true self, which is boundless, intimately connected to all, excluding nothing. As for Musashi, the sword saint, there's a story about an incident that occurred late in his life, long after he ceased his violent dueling. Musashi and a companion were sitting in meditation in a cave when a poisonous snake crawled in. It crawled across the companion's lap. However, sensing the presence of death on Musashi, it changed direction, circling widely around him. Though he had exchanged for his violent ways for a spiritual path, the energy of so much killing could not be extinguished in that single life. Ultimately, some of the later martial arts, whose perspectives were shaped by this purposeful Rimin, advanced far in the direction of nonviolence. Gichin Funakoshi, who brought karate-do from Okinawa to Japan, tells two beautiful stories about the peaceful resolution of potentially violent conflicts that occurred while he was studying with his Okinawan teachers as a young man. The first of these occurred when a group of karate students were returning from a moon-viewing party with their teacher, Master Itosu, when out of the darkness they were confronted by a group of would-be assailants. Funakoshi reasoned that the number of these thugs was approximately the same as that of the teacher and his students. Unless these were also karate adepts, the outcome would be fairly certain. Funakoshi thought that this might be the opportunity to use their skills in a real fight. But that was not the case. Instead, Itosu instructed Funakoshi to go forward and talk with these men. They may not be bad men at heart, and if you tell them I'm a member of the party, that may make all the difference. As Funakoshi's attempts to negotiate progressed, one member of the gang started to grab him. Funakoshi immediately sunk into a karate stance when Itosu's voice boomed out, "No fighting, Funakoshi. Listen to what they have to say. Talk to them." Ultimately, Itosu's identity was recognized and the confrontation temporarily averted. Then Itosu gave his students an instruction that mystified Funakoshi. Rather than continuing on their way, he instructed them to return whence they had come. Itosu forbade them from even talking about the incident, while acknowledging that they had done a good job and would become first-rate karateka. Later, Funakoshi learned that the group that confronted them was only a few...
It's 10 o'clock.
Thank you. Feeling the effects of too much liquor. Realizing this, he had an important insight. It was only then I realized how clever the master had been in ordering us to return to Shuri by a different route, so as to avoid any further encounters. Therein, I thought, lies the meaning of karate. My cheeks grew hot and red as I realized, but for Itosu, I would have used my skill and strength against untrained men. In the second incident, Funakoshi walking alone faces two men who he quickly realizes are not just overly rowdy drunks. These two demand his money. Funakoshi explains he does not have any. Then they ask for tobacco. Again, Funakoshi does not have any. Finally, they demand to know what he does have. At the time, he was carrying manju, cakes to offer at the altar in his father-in-law's home. These he let the men have. Later, Funakoshi related the incident to both Itosu and his second teacher, Master Azato. Itosu praised his action, indicating that the time spent teaching Funakoshi karate had been well spent. Then Azato inquired as to what he had done at the altar of his father-in-law without the cake. Funakoshi responded, "Since I had nothing else, I offered a heartfelt prayer." "Ah, good, good," cried Azato. "Well done indeed." These two masters who never praised Funakoshi for his execution of a kata now warmly praised his refusal to fight. In Funakoshi's view, these two incidents represent the essence of karate-do. He felt that the art was far too serious and potentially dangerous to be used in anything less than dire life and death circumstances. This was the evolution that the martial arts in Japan went through while strongly influenced by the purposeful mean during the period from the late 1500s when Musashi was born to the Meiji Restoration in the late 1800s when Funakoshi studied karate. In that later stage, the strength and influence of the communitarian Bimin was also beginning to exert its influence, as will be seen. The Achievers Bimin regards strategy, technology, and competitiveness to be the means to advance humanity. It believes that risk-taking, self-reliant people deserve to be proportionately rewarded. Certainly, this is one of the most dominant, if not the primary, Bimin functioning in this country today. It is also reflected in contemporary American martial arts. Certainly, there are many that regard martial arts as a career, a profession, a path to both recognition and monetary success. Many dojos and dojangs are large and successful businesses, often having change of schools and geographically diverse locations. Martial arts skill and entrepreneurship have commingled to a very great extent. Many of the most respected martial artists in this country today are admired as much for their business acumen as for their skill in the practice of their art. Conversely, there are those who feel that the true spirit of the purposeful mean influenced martial arts is being preserved in the tiny classes taught in basements, garages, and school gyms, rather than in the sometimes elaborate and highly commercialized dojos. However, the other large impact of the Achievers Bimin in this country and in many other nations as well is the trend to transformation of these arts into a competitive sport. My own art of Taekwondo made a huge step in that direction when it chose to work towards being an Olympic sport. The ability to win trophies or to coach athletes to win becomes the primary focus. In some instances, the purposeful codes, such as the code of Budo, have been abandoned altogether in favor of the rules and attitudes appropriate to sport competition. In other cases, they remain, but with far less emphasis than in a traditional setting. Often the dojo where the Achievers Bimin is dominant could be said that the do or way has been completely lost. Instead, what remains is a fancy form of pugilistic competition loosely derived from Asian arts. Depending on the style and orientation of the school, this competition can range from purely point sparring to a mixture of point and knockout fighting to all-out brawling in the manner of ultimate fighting. To those of us who hold the more traditional viewpoint, the introduction of the Achievers Bimin represents a great step back from the code of values and the strict order and the distinct sense of responsibility of the purposeful-oriented martial arts. The communitarian BMIM values inner peace and self-exploration in a shared context, where ultimately the community manifests caring. Spiritual harmony and enriched human development are all themes in the growth of these systems, which are devoted to both sharing and caring. This theme was clearly emerging in the Karate of Funakoshi's time. Both based on Funakoshi's accounts, it appears clear that both Okinawan masters Itosu and Azatu recognized that the inner transformation of the Karateka, that which gave them the inner peace, the strength, and the courage to avoid conflict, was far more important than physical prowess. In this view, physical prowess is in fact only the path followed to achieve this profound inner change. The integrative BMIM emphasizes the broadening of our understanding of our relationship to the universe and its systems as operating in interdependent natural patterns. It values flexibility, spontaneity, and functionality. In contemporary martial arts, those three adjectives of flexibility, spontaneity, and functionality cannot help but call to mind the martial arts of Bruce Lee's Jeet Kune Do, as does the integrative shift away from rank, power, and status to knowledge and competency as the ultimate determinant. Bruce Lee saw Jeet Kune Do as the artless art, the art that is formless so that it can assume all forms. Bruce devoted himself ceaselessly to the study of many martial arts, drawing kernels of functionality from each and discarding the rest. Function and not style was important. In fact, Bruce saw style as a restriction, inhibiting the free flow of actions and techniques. He said to understand Jeet Kune Do, one ought to throw away all ideas, patterns, styles. In fact, he should throw away even the concept of what is or what isn't ideal in Jeet Kune Do. Can you look at a situation without naming it? Naming it, making it a word, causes fear. As was mentioned earlier, Bruce also drew from Zen. He saw the emptiness of Mushin as an opportunity for the martial artist in combat, as Taekwon did several hundred years earlier. The great mistake is to anticipate the outcome of an engagement. You ought not be thinking of whether it ends in victory or defeat. Let nature take its course, and your tools will strike at the right moment. Let your tools strike at the right moment? Yes, far from eschewing violence, Bruce's conclusion is startling. Approach Jeet Kune Do with the idea of mastering of will. Forget about winning and losing. Forget about pride and pain. Let your opponent graze your skin, and you smash into his flesh. Let him smash into your flesh, and you fracture his bone. Let him fracture your bones and you take his life. Do not be concerned with escaping safely. Lay your life before him. Certainly, the measured restraint of the purposeful being has clearly been eliminated in this interpretation of free-flowing integration. Letting nature take its course, acting in harmony with the Tao, does martial arts reach this conclusion? Let him fracture your bones and you take his life? Give greater violence than you receive? While I have a great deal of respect for Bruce's physical prowess and dedication to martial arts, I personally feel deeply ashamed that two traditions of which I am a practitioner, Zen Buddhism and martial arts, could collaborate to reach such a conclusion. To suggest that violence should be met with even greater violence? In a sense, this is the potential dark side of the integrative being. As we strip away the structure and the deep sense of responsibility that was present in the purposeful meme, martial arts, along with the communitarian sense of the broad implications of our actions, the escalation of violence is a conclusion that can be reached. However, the integrative aspect of the yellow beaming was also a strong influence on another martial artist, Horehai Ueshiba, whom John Stevens refers to as the prophet of the art of peace. Where Shiva's sense of integration reaches a very different conclusion. The totally awakened warrior can freely utilize all elements contained in heaven and earth. The true warrior learns how to correctly perceive the activity of the universe and how to transform martial art techniques into vehicles of purity, goodness, and beauty. A warrior's mind and body must always be permeated with enlightened wisdom and deep calm. However, while the development of Wei Shiba's Aikido, the way of harmony, was significantly influenced by the integrative meme, growing out of Jiu-Jitsu, Shinto, Buddhism, and many other influences, it is through the influence of the holistic meme, which will be explored next, that it found its full expression. The holistic Vimim is described as experiencing the wholeness of existence through mind and spirit. It sees the individuated self as part of a larger whole, with both the separation and wholeness being valid aspects of reality. Everything in the universe is interconnected and interdependent. This is very much the Buddhist understanding that was taught by Shakyamuni Buddha some 2,500 years ago. It also appears to be the Vimim that is reflected by Wei Shiba's art of Aikido. In spite of the idiosyncratic and sometimes a bizarre life of Wei Shiba, who adopted a mixture of Shinto Buddhist influences, it appears that in 1925 he had a profound spiritual experience that changed his life. As he walked in his garden after a match with a kendo master, during which the opponent never landed a blow, the following occurred. Suddenly the earth trembled. Golden vapor welled up from the ground and engulfed me. I felt transformed into a golden image, and my body seemed light as a feather. I could understand the speech of birds. All at once I understood the nation of creation. The way of a warrior is to manifest divine love, a spirit that embraces and nurtures all things. Tears of gratitude and joy streamed down my cheeks. I saw the entire earth as my home, the sun, moon, and stars as my intimate friends. All attachment to material things vanished. Emerging as the spiritual warrior, Wei Shiba went on to accomplish feats in the martial arts that have never been equaled. However, I feel that these pale when compared to his teachings of the art of peace. Those who practice the art of peace must protect the domain of Mother Nature, the divine reflection of creation, and keep it lovely and fresh. Warriorship gives birth to natural beauty. The subtle techniques of the warrior arise as naturally as the appearance of spring, summer, water, winter. Warriorship is none other than the vitality of all life. The art of peace does not rely on weapons or brute force to succeed. Instead, we put ourselves in tune with the universe, maintain peace in our own realms, nurture life, and prevent dirt, death, and destruction. The true meaning of the term samurai is one who serves and adheres to the power of love. Love, calm, purity, goodness, hardly the adjectives that were or even are today associated with the warrior. Out of Wei Shiba's enlightenment came a totally fresh understanding of martial arts as a tool for an expression of profound spiritual transformation. In Wei Shiba's hands, the sword that gives and takes life freely was revealed as the true basis of the arts. What is clear from Wei Shiba's teaching is that martial arts, under the influence of the holistic paradigm, have little to do with physical conflict and everything to do with a profound relationship to the entire universe. The warrior's task is now the creation of healing, of understanding, of love. Terry Dobson's story of an encounter on the Tokyo subway is a clear example of the working of this warrior's art. It took place while Dobson, himself an Aikido practitioner, was in Japan training. One day, while traveling back to his home from the dojo, the passengers on his train were being intimidated by a loud, coarse, and obviously intoxicated passenger. Dobson himself, like many a martial artist, began to consider that this might be his moment of truth, when he could at long last use his art in a valiant, redeeming, heroic effort. All of his years of practice would be justified. Suddenly, A shout echoed through the train car. The ruffian's attention was directed towards an old man who had made the shout. He stormed over, ready for a confrontation, only to be greeted by a warm smile and the old man empathically connecting with his anger. "You must have had a very difficult day," the old man said. "Would you like to talk about it?" "What do you care? You know nothing about my life," the ruffian responded. "No, you're right," the old man replied. "I would like to hear about it, though." So the conversation was begun. The ruffian was, in fact, grieving deeply over the recent death of his wife, whose pain had brought him to drink in anger. The old man continued the empathic connection, sharing that he and his wife had recently lost their beloved son. Soon the ruffian was sobbing on the old man's shoulder, and the old man invited him home to sit in the garden and share tea with he and his wife. Dobson, meanwhile, realized that he had completely misunderstood the teachings of Aikido. If he would have chosen a response that involved physical technique and harm to another to resolve the situation. Beck and Callan, in their exploring of spiral dynamics and describing the emergence of the V-memes, tell us that they do not yet clearly see what the V-meme bomb that will follow the holistic will be. I would like to suggest that within this holistic paradigm, there remains room for considerably deeper understanding. As we go further in this direction, we enter the realm of what I would like to call radical responsibility. Holism goes far in realizing that this discrete individual is also part of a much greater whole, the harmony of which each entity is an expression of and is responsible. Throughout history, there are those who have understood the profound connection of all existence, and by implication, the necessity of living a human life that is dedicated to relieving the suffering of all beings. In Buddhism, these persons are called bodhisattvas. It is said that the bodhisattva is so deeply identified with the universal relief of pain and misery that she or he will refuse to enter nirvana, choosing instead to return to this existence time and again until all beings are saved from suffering. However, Buddhism obviously does not hold a claim to this archetype. In every religion, we can see examples of the great saints, those who are completely, totally, within every cell, within every pore, with all of their living energy, they're dedicated to peace, healing, the preservation of life and the relief of suffering. Shantideva is one such figure whose work, the Bodhicharyavatara, or the Way of the Bodhisattva, has greatly impacted Mahayana Buddhism and especially Tibetan Buddhism. Shantideva's words are remarkable. "This body I have given up to serve the pleasure of all living beings. Let them kill and beat and slander it, and do to it whatever they desire. Though they treat it like a toy, though they make it the butt of mockery, my body has been given up to them. There's no use now to make much of it. And so let beings do to me whatever does not bring them injury. Whenever they catch sight of me, let this not fail to bring them benefit." He continues, "May I be a guard for those who are protectorless, a guide for those who journey on the road. For those who wish to go across the water, may I be a boat, a raft, a bridge. May I be an isle for those who yearn for landfall, a lamp for those who long for light, and for those who need a resting place, a bed. For all who need a servant, may I be their slave. May I be the wishing jewel, the vase of plenty, a word of power and the supreme healing. May I be the tree of miracles, and for every being, the abundant cow." For Shantideva, there is not only no self-defense, and there is no self to defend. He willingly offers his body, his life, his very being, for the sake of others. He brings the art of the warrior forth fully onto the spiritual battlefield. As seasoned fighters face the swords of enemies on the battle line, lightly dodge the weapons of defilement and overcome the foe with nimble skill. The foe that he is speaking of here is our own negative emotions, as the Dalai Lama explains in his commentary, A Flash of Lightning in the Dark of Night. Hearing this radical perspective of the Bodhisattva, we may react with incredulity. We may associate Shantideva's profound commitment with that of the greatest teachers of peace and nonviolence, Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, the Dalai Lama. How could this be possible for us, ordinary persons? In this context, I would like to share a story about Herbie, which some of you have heard before. Herbie is an inmate in a New York State correctional facility and is also a Zen student of our senseis, Nguyen Nyeka, except for Margaret. One day, Herbie was confronted by another inmate who came up and told him that he was going to kick his ass. Herbie asked his opponent to wait a minute. He calmly removed his glasses, placed them in his pocket. He put his hands behind his back and told the man to go ahead and wail away. The would-be assailant went off muttering. Herbie's reaction was not one of self-defense. It was one of no defense. Yet through offering no defense, a peaceful resolution was achieved. Speaking of that story, I'm also reminded of the powerful scenes in the movie Gandhi, when the lines of Indian common folk file off silently, knowing they will be savagely beaten by the British officials. As each bloody, unconscious body was dragged off, another person moved to take their place, offering no defense. Ultimately, India's freedom was won without massive bloodshed. This same extraordinary commitment was also displayed time and time again in our southern states during the freedom movement. Again, those who were truly inspired by the teaching of Martin Luther King offered no defense. Many were beaten and even murdered. But again, persons who refused to fight, who offered nothing but passive resistance, accomplished massive change. Could this then be the next step in the development of the martial arts, the ultimate transformation of the warrior archetype? The warrior hero once again stepping forward, blade flashing, to release us from the status quo, opening the way for transformation? Is this the next step, moving towards peace, bringing the great unification of the long-standing schism in the archetype between the spiritual and the practical? The levels of spiral dynamics also apply to each of our individual journeys of development. Many of us in the traditional martial arts are strongly influenced by the purposeful mean conjoined with the communitarian values, as was the case for Funakoshi and his teachers, Itosu and Asato. Still others may be in tune with the integrative, holistic idea of Weishiba. In fact, if we take an open and non-judgmental approach, the specifics of where we are today is irrelevant. What is relevant is whether or not we are, as martial artists, willing to accept responsibility for the creation of peace through ever deeper understanding of violence and nonviolence, and through the process of diminishing those attachments which obstruct our own ability to practice peace. In fact, this is the path that many of us have unknowingly been following for some time. Many people begin their martial arts training strongly influenced by the survivalistic belief. Motivated by the fear of violence, they first walk out onto the dojo floor looking to acquire the capacity for self-defense. Gaining physical power and mastery of others, the impulsive beaming motivations influence a second group. Others may take their first steps wanting the acknowledgement of the achievers beaming, hoping to win tournaments and take home trophies. Whatever the initial motivation, if they are study training with a good teacher in a strong traditional dojo, this changes. The survivalist will become less fearful as they gain skill. Realizing that there is nothing to fear, they naturally become calmer and less defensive. Gradually, they would become so skilled that they would agree with Funakoshi that martial arts should not be used under any but the direst life and death circumstances. As they continue to travel down the path of practice, they may then begin to loosen their grasp on the needs of their self, opening to true compassion and the greater needs of others. The impulsive individual will quickly find out that their desires will not be tolerated. They will either learn to join in the communitarian spirit of the dojo, working for the common good, or they will drift away. There's no room in the serious dojo for the individual whose motivation is power over others. However, when those persons do manage to stay, they too learn about true power. They realize there is no gratification in hurting or dominating others. They realize that nothing is gained or proven through senseless conflict. The achievist will not find their expectations fulfilled in true practice. The skilled teacher does not reward egotism. She or he teaches that the goal of practice is practice itself, not the acquisition of rewards that inflate the sense of self-importance. On the practice floor, there are no heroes. In the true martial arts, those that prepare us to live consciously and responsibly, there are no winners or losers. The achievist will either give up their attachment to glory or move on to a school that satisfies that desire. Thus, as we progress in the martial arts practice, many attachments begin to loosen. Our self begins to diminish in importance. The communitarian and holistic scheme has become stronger, ultimately making nonviolence the only acceptable alternative. Eventually, the martial artist begins to realize, as Terry Dobson did, that the highest expression of our arts is in the peaceful resolution of conflict. This then gives us a vision of what the martial art that is the true way, a path of transformation and nonviolence looks like. It is one where hard practice is its own reward. When practice is done this way, with mindfulness, sincerity, respect, and full commitment, transformation can begin to take place. Gradually, the locus of our lives shifts from an ever-diminishing sense of self to a deep awareness of our connection to and responsibility for all things. In the true dojo, a sense of communality and shared purpose pervades. It is a place where deep respect, not only for the teacher or teachers, but also for everyone on the floor, exists. All are sisters and brothers, not in the superficial back-slapping high-five way that we see in sports, but in the sense of intimate connection experienced by those traveling a difficult physical and spiritual path together. Eventually, training in this way, we begin to experience mushin, our first glimpse of the open space of shunyata, emptiness. However, we must realize that this is not an end in itself. It is not a safe place to dwell, or we can fall into indifference or worse, sociopathy. It is a doorway to realizing what Buddhists call our true self, our unborn mind, or our Buddha nature. However, a skilled spiritual teacher must guide the person moving through this door. Without this guidance, the way can be perilous and the mistakes grievous. Thus, further progress along the path means that martial arts practice must be augmented by serious spiritual practice. Finally, with much hard work and perseverance, we may reach the point, as our attachments diminish, and to where our true compassion is revealed, where truly, deeply we realize that we must take responsibility for all the violence in the world, and that we must actively work for peace with every ounce of our being. I'm not talking about going on peace marches, although that is not precluded. What I am talking about is what Thich Nhat Hanh calls being peace, developing peace in every moment of our lives, with every breath, with every action. This is not easy. Greed, anger, and ignorance, what Buddhism calls the three poisons, arise within us constantly. From these, we each construct and contain all of the vimiyas. In one moment, we are fearful, in the next desiring power. In another moment, we want glory and recognition, and so on. This reality of our human nature means that the work of being peace is never accomplished. It must be a constant, lifelong process. This, I believe, is the fulfillment of the warrior archetype. The greatest warrior raises the sword of Manjushri, the sword that cuts through attachments and delusions, the sword that brings peace. Then he or she can freely slash away the weeds that bind those around them, revealing the splendid view that has always been there. This is why Shiva's warrior. The totally awakened warrior can freely utilize all elements contained in heaven and earth. The true warrior learns how to correctly perceive the activity of the universe and how to transform martial arts techniques into vehicles of purity, goodness, and beauty. A warrior's mind and body must be permeated with enlightened wisdom and deep calm. In the end, will we be able to act as Herbie did in the face of violence? Will we reach the complete relinquishment of self that Shanti Devi did? I can't answer that. What I do know is that as we walk this path together as martial artists, each of us can grow more peaceful, thereby making the whole world more peaceful. So answering this question which has brought us together today, martial arts, are they violent or nonviolent? Each of us will determine that by what is in our hearts. Go within yourself for the answer. Perhaps someday every dojo will be a place for practicing the way of peace, and the sword of the warrior will flash brightly, preparing the way for the emergence of the creative energy of the source as the outworn is cut down. Life will be given, life will be taken away. Thank you.
So, this is the opportunity to add whatever questions, comments, thoughts, criticisms that you would like. My personal would be very interesting in what people may have heard or seen.
Well done.
Very much. Ironically, the person you're calling Herbie is actually Peter.
Oh.
And his Dharma name is
Mushin.
Really?
Yes.
Ultimately, we are all Peter.
I think that's
actually, the name that I wanted to give him was an Italian name, Testa Uda, which means hard head. But Margaret didn't allow that.
Thank you. I stand corrected.
I had that experience. I started studying martial arts. I was interested in the spiritual side of it, but I was very angry. I was very angry, and I'm very kinesthetic. And I mean, I was brought up to never fight verbally or physically, and something about being able to work through that anger physically by expressing movement allowed me to let go of it, and a lot of it. And I had a teacher whose philosophy was, if you can run away from an opponent, that's your first option. If you can get away, you run away. And as you said, I think having that kind of teacher who's aware, who has a peaceful approach, I think that completely cultivated that for me. So that once I was more adept, I didn't really ever see myself ever using it. There should be no need to.
Do you
can also work on running very fast. Is that the same thing? Would there be something to be said for saying something, or, you know, trying, is running away resolving it peacefully? Or is, like, the almost unreachable wisdom of the guy on the subway who says, "Oh!" and then smiles at the guy, or the guy who puts his hands behind his back. You know, all of them sound great. But when you think of Gandhi wanted to leave, he wanted to awaken. And I assume this is what Peter did in the prison. Wanted to awaken in the other person their fundamental sense of, I don't know whether it's decency or not, but Gandhi said to the British, "We're not going to throw you out, you're going to go out because you want to." So, I don't know. I mean, this is all up in the Himalayas for me.
We don't know that Peter was that advanced he was thinking that he didn't pray for. But what he had done, like everyone who's taken to God here, he had taken a lot of non-violence. And he took it totally seriously. And from that time on, he did his best to live a life of non-violence. I don't know that he had enough awareness to realize he could awaken anything in his moments. But yet his dedication to his vows, there were guards who saw the incident and they were just floored and awed that he could do that. And he did change people.
Well, it sounds different from where you were.
Yeah, I don't think that I ever had an awareness that I was trying to teach anybody nonviolence or I was trying to affect the world. I think it was just the notion of, the very basic notion of, this is not to be taken lightly. You are not to use what you have learned just for fun or to get into a fight. Your first option is to resolve it in some other way. Yeah.
That was my own experience. Same thing. And it was a way to gain power. It was a way, the initial onset back in the early 60s. A way to protect myself. Matter of fact, my first sensei was Japanese. And he said this, and I trained. I was stationed down in Louisiana at the time. He said to me, I guess it was after about 3 months of training, he said, "You don't seem angry anymore." And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You don't want revenge anymore." And I didn't experience that. I wasn't looking for that, but that came to be through his training. It was diligent training. And it progressed on through that. When I got out of the service and I studied under an American and I got trained under another Japanese instructor, and he was very humble, studied under Funakoshi, actually. And that's the way I grew up in the martial arts. But Peter and I had an interesting conversation, and where I am personally with today is that the conversation of this gentleman, Peter, who stood there, put his hands behind his back and said, "Have fun." I take a little bit of a different approach on it. I say, if I have the techniques and I can stop myself from being destroyed, and Peter does a good example of this. We did it. There was a demonstration he did to a group of people. and just turn a person around and guide them in another direction, not hurting them or anything, but giving them a different look, or just delaying it so you can talk with them like Funakoshi did, or Shiba, be able to redirect it and open up a conversation with them, go home, invite them to your home, sit down over a cup of coffee or whatever, and discuss it. And then it gives you an opportunity to do it over and over and over again, where had this person that may have confronted him really taken him apart or destroyed the individual, he's only got one shot at it. Whereas if you can protect this gift that's here on the earth, you've got that potential, you know you've got that potential, and you don't need it. You don't need to. It's not required. You don't need to use it, but you know how to redirect the flow of energy so you can use it for a good cause. You can make good of it, and you can do it over and over and over again, and you don't get destroyed in the process. That was kind of my take.
You just reminded me of a story. I think it's Peter Matheson that tells this story, floats up out of that, which was about one of the earlier Japanese Zen teachers, maybe Yasutani, I'm not sure who the story was about, but who had come to New York, and all the students that he wanted to go out for a walk in Central Park, and the students all said, you know, then say, oh, you know, that's not a really good idea. And he, you know, kind of sloughed them off, and no, that's okay, I'll go for a walk, you know. So, well, they, after a while, he hadn't come back, and they were very, very concerned. So they all ran out to look for him. And they got to his apartment and found him sitting there drinking tea with a group of gang members. And so, you know, that skillfulness, he turned it, you know. Sorry, I didn't sort of say how that all evolved, but they hadn't even talked to him.
The skill takes your fear away from having the opportunity to do that. Because you know at any time you could, you have it there to use, but it takes that fear away from the situation. Fear isn't there anymore. And you can, you're not throwing yourself down as a masochist to be destroyed. Literally, if you don't have that skill, you're not throwing yourself down so you're destroyed. You're saying, let's talk about it. Where can we go with it? You know, what can I learn from you? What can you learn from me? That kind of thing. You know, how can we make it a better place so this doesn't happen again?
But the vow of nonviolence includes maybe it won't work.
Right.
And if it doesn't work, you do what the group in Gandhi's group did. You simply stand there. And look at it. You do what people in the South do. You stand and look at it. The man who really turned my life, I was a teacher at Goddard College, and beautiful person. And his picture is on the wall upstairs. And he was accosted in the streets of New Jersey by a gang and a kid. I know Ed never looked at him. Mm-hmm. And I know he said, let's go out, let's talk about it. And that's Ed. But he was killed. So you have to realize nonviolence means doesn't necessarily mean you're going to make it. Mm-hmm. So when you take the vow, you say, no matter what happens, as you recall it from Charlotte Hayden, this is the way it's going to be. That's the reality. On the other hand, we also know that there are many, many beautiful stories of people's lives being changed by such an encounter. That also is possible.
Do you also view that idea of redirection of an opponent as an opportunity to further discussion and further peaceful interaction? Or do you see it as a, you should see him in the dealing with him?
Well, given the idea that there's a big gap between seeing and doing. And so, but, you know, I mean, I think if I have the idea that I have an opponent, I've already made a mistake.